So, hello, everyone.
Hi.
Today, we're going to be talking on this podcast about how to lie with statistics. And we have Sarah, Raven, Ellen, and myself, who is Brent. So, I guess we'll first start with the introduction.
Yeah, we're going to be talking from the introduction through chapter 3. We all kind of thought that the introduction was like really weird and it didn't have much to do with the actual book once we started reading the chapters. I guess it just kind of like started talking about how to think through a statistical mindset, and like I really like this quote that says, "The secret language of statistics, so appealing in a fact-minded culture, is employed to sensationalize, inflate, confuse, and oversimplify." So like, it's kind of like, what's the word? Like, they're, I don't know, insulting statisticians, but in a way they're saying, like, even though this is a bad thing, this is how you do it to make it right. I don't know. So that was an introduction.
Chapter 1 was called The Sample with the Built-in Bias. So, basically, it was a survey that was done with the Yale, with the average Yale men of class of 24. So I'm guessing, what, 19, 24, maybe?
Yeah.
So, it was kind of confusing, though, because they said that people were making about $25,000 a year. But at first, like, that's not a lot, though.
Well, back then,
it was
a big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal. 1924. Yeah, okay.
And it also made, like, it made Yale, like, look really good. Because people coming out of that school would make $25,000 in the 20s. That's, like, really good. But I just, I liked how he, like, broke it down into ways that, like, you can tell that it's a lie.
Yeah, but he was also talking about how they were focusing on the more famous or more well-off people.
Right. How they left behind the...
They didn't talk about the down, I guess.
Yeah.
Poor
ones. They talked about the people who were, like, homeless and on drugs and things like...
Basically the ones who didn't want to own up to how much money they made.
Yeah.
Right. Because they were either embarrassed or they just didn't want to say it because...
This personal.
They just didn't reply.
Right.
I think one of the examples that really helped, like, tie in this situation, like, with probability and stuff like that is when he talked about the barrel of beans, and he was like, you can, you know, some are red, some are white. There's only one way to find out exactly how many of each color you have. Count them.
Right.
Oh, and then another thing in chapter one that was kind of interesting is how he was talking about how there's always some sort of bias, and he said always there's always a possibility of bias somewhere. There always is. So, like, in every situation, no matter what it is, there's always going to be a bias. And then he explains how we can, like, look for it, which I thought was interesting.
There was also, let me see if I can find it. It was an example of this survey they did with magazines.
Here it is.
They said, like, there were respondents who were asked which magazine that they read the most, which was, it was Harper's, it was called Harper's or True Story? Yeah, Harper's or True Story. And most respondents that came back and said that they read the True Love Story, but the publisher's figures came back that True Love Story had a much higher circulation than Harper's.
I thought chapter one did a really, like, he did a really nice job talking about samples and, like, how you can really tell if there's a random sample.
Oh, yeah.
And then he did the example about the psychiatrist who said, like, who reported that practically everyone's neurotic, but he was a psychiatrist, so all the people that he interviewed were, like, needed help because they were going to him. So it was just, like, how can a sample really be random or not? And, like, what type of people to use and stuff.
Also, going off of what Raven was talking about with the magazines, he was stating that these magazines were not what they could have read, but just what they had in their house or household. Because I know I had, like, many magazines in my household, and I never touch them, and I don't look at them, but it's just what happens to be around.
Yeah.
So I feel like that happens with a lot of people.
Go ahead. So the author basically is just saying that, you know, with any statistic that is given, make sure that the person who is doing the survey or anything like that is questioning the sample that's being taken, and that there's always going to be some type of bias, you know, in the sample or whatever it is that's being given to them. So
He says this quote about bias. So you go into the streets and bias your sample against stay-at-homes. You go from door to door by day and miss employed people. You switch to evening interviews and neglect moviegoers and nightclubbers.
Yeah.
So you're always going to have some type of bias, even if you're trying to be the most fair.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he did a good example of explaining that, because he did the time, and then he did, on page 24, he talks about race, how that also is bias.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he said, like, there's always going to be bias. Mm-hmm. Do you want to move on?
Well, I do have one point.
Okay.
Do you guys remember reading about the toothbrush? I was confused on that. I didn't, like, really understand what he was, like, trying to refer to so much. Like, he was talking about brushing, someone brushing their teeth 1.02 times a day. And, of course, that's a statistic, so it's not like someone actually brushes their teeth.
Where does that point to?
It's, on page 17 and 18. And then on the next page, he goes into, they don't tell the frequency of which bristle is applied to the incisor. And it was just, I didn't really see the purpose of that so much.
With that
in this
example.
Yeah, because he was going from the magazines to just
toothbrush. And then also what Helen was talking about the race.
Oh, how he went from blacks to Nazis?
Yeah, like on page 24, in the second paragraph, it says one question was, would blacks be treated better or worse here if the Japanese conquered the USA? And then it says black interviewers reported that 9% of those they asked said better. And then it said white interviewers found only 2% of such responses. And while black interviewers found only 25%, who thought blacks would be treated worse, white interviewers turned up 45%. And then it talks about the Nazis and how they were substituted for the Japanese. And I was, it was confusing because it was going from one thing
to another.
And then to race. And I was just like, oh, my goodness. This is
yeah. I feel like that's what this book is going to. I mean, we've only read like a small chunk of it.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's what this book is about. Just giving us like example after example
snippets.
To try to make us at least understand one of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Brent didn't understand the toothbrush one, and I didn't understand, really, the race one.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, we can relate to other ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, we all pretty much understood the Yale one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
the beans
magazines.
And the barrel
right.
magazines.
I think he has good intentions. He's just, like, giving us a lot of information. So
all
we
over
can
the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then somebody from, like, every type of...
will understand at least one,
Well, I guess we can move on to
chapter two, the well-chosen average.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that was basically talking about mean, median, and moon.
Yeah, it first started off with the housing stuff, I believe, like the neighborhood, like how much they need in the neighborhood.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I forget the actual number. I think it was like
$15,000
a year
versus $3,500.
Yeah, $3,500. Yeah.
But yeah, at first when I started reading it, I was actually a little confused because I wasn't thinking in the mindset of like the statistical person.
I thought I was picking up a book.
Basically. So when he said that you could make $15,000, that's like low, but I guess in that time it's like
it was high.
Yeah.
Very high.
But then dropping down to $3,500, I'm just like,
I just didn't
understand. But going more so into the chapter, it made sense, and it was like. It was a good way, I guess, to trick people in a way. It's like, it kind of teaches you how to be, I guess, a criminal in a way to me.
Yeah.
Like, it teaches you how to, I don't know, get over on someone.
Yeah, how to persuade them if they don't know what it means.
If they don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So there's the diagram on page 33 where it has the pictures of the people and the salaries.
Yeah.
And then they show, like, here's the average, which
mm-hmm.
is the guy in the middle.
Yeah.
And then there's the median. which is, like, you know, the same amount of people on top of him and the bottom of him, and then the mode, which is, like, all of the 2,000 people.
The majority.
Yeah, that definitely helped me understand this whole chapter.
I feel like the pictures in this book are really, like,
there
to help guide you.
It kind of correlates with what we've been learning in class, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, about how the mean is kind of just taking the average. But the author explains in the book that, talk about arithmetic mean. That's what he's saying, right?
Yeah,
arithmetic mean. But he says that he's talking about the average and how they're like two different things, kind of. The arithmetic average or the mean is the sum of the qualities, the quantities. I'm sorry. So like in page 33, when you were talking about the average, that's just everybody put together divided by how many people. It was, and then the median is kind of the middle person.
Yeah.
And then, like we said earlier, the mode is kind of how many times, well, who had the most.
When learning this, though, not even in statistics, but like in
middle school,
elementary school, being taught this, it was completely different. Like, I was always taught that the mean was the average.
Yeah,
like,
that's what
the
I'm
median
about.
And mode were just like accessories in a way, and it just gave you more information. So, learning that these you can use these as an actual average is interesting.
And I also liked how you can use them to change it in your benefit.
Yep.
Yeah.
So like on pages 32 and 34, it says like average wage of employees was 2,000, and then average daily salary of profit owners was 26. And then he like changed the average, the median, and the mode in a way that it didn't look like the profit owners had that much, because then it was only 5,000. I just thought that was really, really interesting. How you can have the same answers, but portray it in a
different
way.
They had an example on page 36 about the Time magazine, and they were really focusing on the median, saying that if you look on the second paragraph, it says their median age was 34, and their average family income was $7,270 a year. And then they said the earlier surveys of the old Time magazine had found that their median age was 41 years old, but their income was $9,535. And then the author says the question is why, when the median is given for ages both times, the kind of average for incomes is carefully unspecified. So basically, I think that the author is kind of just breaking it down for us in a more advanced way of how to calculate the mean, the median, and the mode, and not just thinking of it as, you know, the average of everyone, and then just, you know, I think it's kind of cool, but it's also kind of confusing at the same time.
So if you go to page 39, which I think is like the first thing that you really get to see in chapter 3, is when they talk about pennies and how he flips it, and 80% of the time heads show up. So he's saying that you can use that to say science proves that tossed pennies come up heads 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is, we can definitely see in like marketing ads, especially now towards voting time, how we can see like how they twist percentages and statistics all around.
And I think they do that everywhere. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Even just in regular ads.
Yeah, just like even with, when you look at, colleges, like when we're applying to college, and we look at their statistics and saying, oh, we have this certain amount of this race, or we have this certain amount of sports that we offer. And then when I guess you actually like attend or even just like look at the school more so, it gives you, you show that that's not always necessarily true. So I feel like a lot of campaigns and things like that do that to boost their publicity and make them more popular and whatnot.
Because they can give you the statistic, but they don't have to tell you, like, how many times they did it. Like, with the penny one, they only did it 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, goes really well with what we're learning about now, because it's all about what if things are fair or not with coins and stuff. So, I don't know, I just thought that was interesting.
Did you guys understand the toothpaste thing? At all, it
not
was
really.
It
anything
was,
they got to do with brushing teeth.
I know, I was so confused
like,
with all of it. It was just, like, he was talking about the dope toothpaste, and then it was some type
what
of...
What page is that on?
It's on the
on 38.
First, 37 and 38. And then it was talking about some tooth powder, and it was just really, like, confusing. Like, I wasn't sure what they were trying to normally really get at, and then they just switched over to pennies, and I'm just like, okay, this is easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I don't know, more complicated and something, it was weird to open up with, I feel.
Yeah.
Another thing that I thought was weird is how they went to, they stopped at pennies and went right into how, a couple years ago from this book,
mm-hmm.
How they used children as test subjects,
yeah.
and gave some of them vaccines,
yeah.
and they gave some of them not.
And
to see which ones would get polio.
Polio.
I was like, really? You're gonna... okay.
Yeah. That was really...
Yeah, I think with the toothpaste thing, Brent, they was just saying how it's just fewer cavities if you use the dope toothpaste. It was just down by, 23%.
Okay.
So.
I think, sometimes what he does is he's like, I'm going to give you this example, but then explain it with another example.
Yep. Yeah.
So, he gave you the toothpaste one, but then explained it with the pennies, and then went back to the toothpaste, and then went to the polio.
Yep.
So, I don't know.
If you look at the pennies, he talks about one of three things is bound to happen, distinctly more cavities, distinctly fewer, or about the same number.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go to page 40, you can see they did a diagram for the pennies, but it relates to the toothpaste, where
yeah.
it's four possibilities, and then one's like heads, tails, in the middle, or like a bird picks it up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always going to be like that little like strange outcome,
yeah.
I think, is what for both of those situations they're saying.
And then I highlighted, because it like relates to us in class right now, it says, only when there's a substantial number of trials involved, the law of averages a useful description or prediction. So it's saying like, you need a bunch of trials for
mm-hmm.
it to be like a good prediction, but when you're advertising, you don't have to tell that person. So.
This baby on page 44 really threw me off with him smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was kind of like the sidebar thing though, but I didn't really understand that.
Yeah, I was also kind of confused. This whole chapter actually kind of confused me. Like,
yeah,
it
confused me, but I picked up some things.
Yeah, I did pick up some things, but it was something that I had to reread over
mm-hmm.
and over. It wasn't
yeah.
something I could just
read once,
yeah,
understand.
And then just understand.
Mm-hmm. When was this book written?
They were bringing up information from like so
long ago.
Yeah, I feel like it's really old. I don't know why.
It says, okay, Norton Paperback reissue 1993.
That was a reissue, though.
Oh, duh. Okay.
Copyright 1952. 54.
Okay. Yeah, you can tell in his language and some of the stuff that he says.
And, I mean, they bring that up in the book, too. Not about, like, this book, but they bring it up about how using statistics, they tend to, instead of starting, like, a new project, how they take stats from back in time. So that's basically what this book is using stats from back in time, like how they talked about.
Okay.
I wonder how much of it would change if there was another book like this.
Yeah,
I feel like if it was
more modern, I feel like things might be different than what they are. Like, I feel like this book gives a lot of decent information and it's a lot to stem off of, but this is like how many years ago now? Like, this
yeah.
is...
I also think it would be more relatable.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
What else? Yeah, and then they use the example of, like, finding out your baby's height. But instead of, like, taking the average heights from all the kids that are the same age as them,
mm-hmm.
you could just, like, it would make more sense to go back to your grandparents, which I thought was interesting, how, like,
mm-hmm.
statistics basically go by people that are your same age, but it's not... That's not who you are, so you're probably not going to end up
yeah.
with the same results as them.
Yeah, so it's kind of, I guess, focused on genetics in a way. If we're talking about going
yeah,
back towards
one,
your
yeah.
grandparents.
About going back in the past and seeing
yeah.
what they were like
mm-hmm.
instead of what people in the present are like.
Because I know they do that with hair. I know, like, if you just look at your grandfather's hair and you can tell, like, how you'll go bald or whatever
yeah.
will happen.
Yeah.
So.
And the texture of your hair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and we bring this up in class all the time. If we go back a couple pages on 43, they're talking about how, like, you know, how a family of 3.6 persons.
Yeah,
in how we do that all the time in class. We're like, oh, can we just round this?
Yeah,
that makes more sense to us.
Yeah.
Having it to be some type of decimal.
Yep.
You can't, like, just cut something
right.
in half. Like,
yeah.
Where do they get those, that point?
That point six.
That's when they find, like, the average is
the
like
the real average.
Yeah.
Instead of like,
but I understand
what
you're
saying.
Like,
exactly.
Say there was like four of us, but then how do you get like a point if there's four whole people?
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think
it's
like
say if there were like 15 people and they all lived in four houses. How many people live in each house? If you split that up equally, you're going to get a decimal.
Right. Yeah.
So that's basically
yeah.
what it is.
Because everything in statistics will not be even and balance out correctly to where you can just
right because it's statistics.
Yes. Yeah. So you have to be specific, even though we know in actuality you can't just cut somebody or
mm-hmm.
do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So everything just won't be accurate. You know, what I just said. I kind of like to relate it to, you know, it's kind of corny, but like, do you guys watch Family Feud?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
No? Okay.
Do
you watch Family
Feud? Yes.
Okay, so Steve Harvey, I like to watch it when Steve Harvey is the host. He makes it better. But, sometimes if you hear him say, we surveyed 100 people and the question was whatever,
mm-hmm.
like, whatever the question was. So I kind of, and it makes me mad sometimes because the people who are like the two families, they like to pick their answer and
mm-hmm.
not really think that, oh,
the most popular
it's
answer.
Right, the most popular
mm-hmm.
answer out of 100 people.
They relate it
so,
back to themselves.
Yeah,
so.
But it's also with those 100 people, like when you think about this book, you got to think about who they decided to
yep.
Survey. Because
exactly.
They could have just went downtown and surveyed somebody. And
or they can go in the suburban area
yeah.
or urban
yep.
area.
So
they
can
have, like, different races ask the questions.
Right,
or,
exactly.
And then
so,
the family on the show could be a whole totally different
yep.
race and then not have that
not
type
have the
of
same mentality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like...
But I think sometimes they kind of lose the thought that, you know, they have to kind of think kind of generally.
Yeah.
You know,
and not just
as
themselves.
Right. So.
Yeah, and there's always going to be errors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's all we have for today.
Yep.
I think we covered mostly everything.
I think so. Okay, guys. Thanks, Mr. Miles, for listening.
So there were these two children, Peter and Linda. They were talking about the averages of being 100 with their IQs. Linda had an IQ of 101 and Peter had an IQ of 98. With this information given, they were saying that Linda is above average and Peter is below. So they're saying that Peter isn't as smart as Linda, which was, it made sense, but it was also confusing because then they began to talk about this range in which you cannot say, oh, this person is dumber or smarter because they're one up or one below the average, because that's not the actual true average. They were saying that there's this difference. I think it was like a difference of 3 or so. So like the actual range of it was 98 to 104 or something like that. It was kind of complicated to understand and grasp at first. I had to go back and reread it a couple times because I wasn't sure how to actually process the information. I was trying to relate it to real life situations, as in things that we as teenagers been through. So like taking the SATs, for instance, trying to relate it to the score being low as 600 and to the score being high as, what, 24? But it was such a large difference compared to, like, the 98 and the 104. It wasn't, like, really gathering information. I wasn't processing it right. So
with that being said, also the book talked about the difference between probable error and standard error. And so they use an example of, it's on page 56, just talking about, it was like a fence line that this guy was walking on, and they use a number 3, and
mm-hmm.
so they talked about how he could be
plus or minus three
right.
Yards away. But we don't know for sure whether
plus or minus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he said, basically the probable error is, it measures the error in the measurement based on how much off your measurement, is. So again, whether you're 3 yards below or if you're 3 yards above. So yeah. That was it.
And I related to that. I think everybody can relate to that a little bit. I was getting fitted for my gown from when we were doing cap and gown fittings, and I didn't know if I was wearing heels or flats. So she said, I'll give you enough room so you can wear 2-inch heels or flats.
Right.
So I was like, plus or minus 2 is when I got, you know, is when I can use that in a real life situation.
Yeah, that happened to me too. I didn't know I was wearing heels. So she just said, well, you know, it just, we'll just add
like,
some,
yep.
You know,
just
so it won't be too short
or too long.
They were also talking about within this chapter cigarettes. This whole chapter to me was kind of confusing, but they were talking about Old Gold cigarette people compared to other cigarette companies or brands, whatever you want to call it. And they were trying to, I guess, find out which one was the best. And it was referring to advertisements because Old Gold was very big on advertising that their cigarette was better than other cigarettes, like it was more safer, whatnot. And the case was that they used less of a dangerous product within their cigarette to make it, I guess, more better for you. But at the end of the day, it was still bad. So it was kind of like you can kind of relate it to energy drinks in a way. So maybe like Red Bull, Monsters, all those type of drinks, and how they may say this one is better for you, but they all have these like
awful ingredients.
Yeah, awful ingredients that aren't really beneficial regardless of if they have less of it or not. So it's kind of like cigarettes.
Okay.
Now, chapter 5, the G-Wiz graph. So I thought it was interesting to see the imagery for this chapter, how you could see, how you can clearly see what's happening with the graph when they showed the man's face.
Yeah, I really felt like the images, it made the chapter, like, they made sense, they fit into the chapter, they, like, if you didn't understand what you were reading, they showed you,
they helped
to see what was going on,
right.
And it made sense.
And especially, on the two graphs on pages 62 and 63, when they have, it's the same graph, but they're scaled differently, on the y-axis, so, for example, on 62, they have it going by 2, so 18, 20, 22, 24, whereas on 63, they have decimals, so 20, 20.2, 20.4, 20.6, yada, yada, yada. The first graph, though, it kind of looks linear, so just like a straight line.
Yeah.
So you think everybody follows that same pattern?
Exactly, whereas on the second graph, you can kind of see
the curves.
Like the curves in it. So, yeah, that I thought that was interesting, and also the use of manipulation.
Yeah, because I feel like manipulation is always used in advertisements that we see today, whether it be in TV, magazines.
Or an election
right.
or something like that.
So I feel like that made interesting.
And I think it's something that we've been seeing like our whole entire lives, so now that we get to see the tricks behind it, it's kind of interesting to see like how these people used their information to distort it for us.
Mm-hmm. And we can kind of base it off of our own assumptions. And what we assume to be true may not or may be true.
But we don't know.
But we just don't know. So I thought it was interesting. I liked this chapter because it gave me more of it. It gave me more insight on how, for an example, the polls work. And how whoever the final people are that calculate all the numbers, like what they do to get the final result, basically. So,
right.
You know, something new to learn.
I think it's interesting because now we can use those tricks for ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. That makes
whether
sense,
it be
yeah.
like for personal uses or for school or for work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but is that it?
Also, with that chapter, I felt like the images were really good. I felt like it made a lot of sense, and then I felt like chapter 6 also made a lot of sense too.
Chapter 6 is what? Oh,
so
the
one-dimensional
picture.
So chapter 6, it was talking about money, I think, like somebody making more than another person,
and then they used a money bag.
Yeah, they used
the
money bag.
Yeah, this is another chapter that the imagery really helps you.
Yeah, it really does.
But they explain how it doesn't help you at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like how it's very misleading and how it can like manipulate any type of situation. So they were talking about these two men. I think one was making a certain amount of money and then the other one was making
double.
They had twice as much.
Mm-hmm.
So they were using imagery to
show this.
They were using the money bags. Yeah, next the money to bags. The
but the money bags were totally off because they were using a different dimension and just twice as much. They were using what
four times
as much.
So they went. They used the wrong ratio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still like it got the message across that that obviously the one man's making more money, but it didn't get the right ratio. So you're thinking that one man's making a whole ton more money.
When it's really not that.
It's not as much.
Not as much
they're portraying.
As they're saying. So
again, it's the manipulation.
Yeah, basically. So like people who are really gullible and who are like always into TVs or magazines and say, oh, I could be making this much, or even when you might be applying for a job and it says like, oh, we give you more than this company or whatever, it just tricks you in a way, which is, I guess, kind of crappy, but for us, we could use it into our advantage so we know in the future in case we see things like this.
Yeah, and in the book, they just used the, what is that, Rotundia versus the USA?
Oh, Rotunda?
Yeah, what did I say?
Rotundia.
Rotunda versus USA, and again, with the whole money thing, they say that the USA makes more money than Rotunda, but again, it's how
just
you
the
grab
way
it and scaling and all that other stuff. So I think chapter 5 and 6 were really, I think these were the best.
The most relatable for us.
So far. And it, you know, makes you look forward to what's to come in a later chapter. So exciting. Yep.
Well, I guess that's it. So until next time. And now we'll be going over to Mr. Miles' questions to our first podcast.
So regarding Mr. Miles' first comment, we looked at the article, and by the graphs we can tell that the size of the y-axis really does matter, because it'll make something like 35% and 39.6% look extraordinarily different than if you were just talking about the numbers.
Exactly. So looking at one of the graphs, the next graph was same data, different y-axis. Just as Helen said, the y-axis really does matter. In this graph, one graph went by 2%, by
0.002%.
And the graph beside it went up by 0.5%. each time.
So you can really tell, because the one on the left looks like it's skewed to the left.
Yes.
So as you can tell, well, if you're looking at it, you should be looking at it. The one on the left looks like it's skewed to the left. And then when you look at a more, you know, even y-axis that somebody else would normally do, you can, it looks like it's straight across. That's because the numbers are only off by 0.00%.
Exactly. So it really does make a difference on how you place your graph and when you actually want to see information in a way.
So this article really 100% relates to pages 62 and 63, which is the picture that we talked about earlier on this podcast, the picture of the man's face on the graphs, how you can see the y-axis distorts it. It either shrinks it or drags it out.
Right. What else?
So further down on the same article, the one that drew our attention was the Florida enacted Stand Your Ground law.
We just had
a lengthy discussion on which way the y-axis should be and how it's kind of confusing.
Yeah, we noticed that it was the zero was at the top and the 800 was at the bottom, and normally it would be the opposite of way around. But we came to the conclusion that the 800 wouldn't be on top because that means it would make it like it's way more crime than.
So Florida is misleading the viewer, trying to make it look like there's less crimes. Moving on, still on the same comment, but now we're looking at our own articles that we found. I found one that's talking about the federal spending as a share of the economy. And it's showing you, I'm just looking at the first graph. And it's kind of similar to one that we already talked about, where it's going by 1%. So if you did this by a scale of, let's say, 5%, the bars would look very similar. So they went really low in their increments.
Right.
so that they could show you the differences, even though it's not really, they're not really that different from each other.
I found an ad on false food advertising. So the first picture depicts Taco Bell, and it shows the advertisements of a delicious beef taco, lettuce, cheese, all that. And then you have a picture to the right of it, which is the actual taco that you would get within the store. And you just see a big, big difference. It doesn't look as full. You don't see as much meat. You don't see a lot of anything. It doesn't really look appealing to the eye. And you notice that this happens in a lot of stores, like a lot of fast food markets, like Burger King does it.
Jack in the Box, McDonald's. Yeah,
every place does things like this to catch viewers, to make them want to come in and buy their food. So it just, it's not more on graphical scaling. It's more of just showing a misleading advertisement and what their food is actually providing.
Like, for example, Burger King makes their burgers look 2 times bigger than they actually are when they serve them to you.
Exactly. But it's still correct in their eyes because they're providing you with everything that's on the burger.
It's just not the same appeal. Like visual.
Right.
Okay, so now moving on to the next comment Mr. Miles left us, which includes 5 lengthy prompts that we have to respond to. The first one, choose one of the quotations inside of the front cover and discuss how it relates to the introduction.
So we chose the one by Artemis Ward. He stated, it ain't so much the things we don't know that get us in trouble, it's the things we know that ain't so.
We related that quote to the second paragraph on page 8, part of the introduction. So the paragraph says, so it is with much that you read and hear. Averages and relationships and trends and graphs are not always what they seem. There may be more than meets the eye, and there may be a good deal less. So that directly, as you heard it, I'm sure you can hear the relation to the quote. It's basically just talking about how things may look one way, but they won't be that way. So the second prompt that Mr. Miles gave us said, put the second paragraph on page 18 of River Cannot into your own words. So the paragraph is basically talking about stats and talking about how these statisticians and stuff take these numbers that are from real people and real sources, and then filter it all down to these little decimal point numbers that pretty much don't mean anything to us except for that they are numbers, and how they go through layer by layer and split up what it actually means and just try to make it so that it's more either appealing or somebody would buy their product or buy what they're selling.
So 3 is talking about which kind of average is the best average to use. Basically, I would say that the best average is mean. With mean, you're taking all of your data, then dividing it by the... You're taking all your data, adding it up, then dividing it by the total amount of data that you have. I feel with that, it gives you an exact average of what these two classes would be like, with these how you could compare their scores. If you do something like Mode, it's very sketchy. It's not as reliable in my opinion, because if you have 2 kids, if you have 4 or more kids that are failing the class with 49s or 50s, and everybody else has these random grades, that would mean that 50 or 49 is your average of the class, which is unfair because only 4 of those kids who have that average. Median is just taking the middle number, which doesn't really tell what the people who have higher scores, the people who have lower scores have. So I feel like the best option would have to be mean. Regarding question 4, it's asking, explain why advertisers often rely on a very small sample or to substantiate their claims. I believe this is because with more samples, you have more variety, which means more difference. And basically, that means if you're looking for a certain average or a certain sample to show, you can't do that with more people because you're getting more opinions, you're getting more information, which means your information could be more spread out, which you may not want. So getting a concentrated amount of information allows you to focus on what you want to focus on and show what you want to show by saying these statistics, something.
So this is in response to Mr. Miles' question regarding the advertisement. So I found a website, and it had to do with the toothpaste brand Colgate. And what happened was there were dentists that came together, and they were doing a survey, you know, talking about which toothpaste was better. And so Colgate just so happened to be the one that they chose. However, there was a survey that showed that it wasn't just Colgate. So they didn't just pick one brand of toothpaste. They picked multiple ones, but they decided to choose Colgate. Therefore, it was kind of like a false advertisement in a way, because the viewers and the audience, they didn't know that there were other choices of brands that were really used. Instead, they switched it around, so to speak, so that they can just advertise Colgate. So for all that being said, the false advertisement, I believe people should really be careful about what they see on TV, because not everything is true. There's a lot that lies behind advertising something just so that it could be appealing to the viewer or to the audience or who, you know, whoever may be watching the advertisement. So there's your answer to that question. All right. So to answer your question about on page 45, when it says hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way, just as 100 tossed pennies will rarely come up exactly 50 heads and 50 tails. I think that means that if you have 100 pennies, you expect it to be 50-50. However, a lot of times it won't come up as that. You may get an off ratio, or maybe it could just be totally off. So in comparison to people, you may meet somebody who you may expect to be a certain way or act a certain way, but in reality, sometimes they're not what you expect. So you just have to go by off of what you have observed, just by, you know, meeting the person or building relationship with the person, same way as with the 100 pennies. You just have to go off by what you observe, which is tossing the pennies and to see what really comes up, but still having the expectation that you will expect that it'll be 50-50. So that's what I think that quote means.
Hello. This is our third and final podcast.
Hello. We'll be talking about chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10.
And it's called The Semi-Attached Figure.
Okay, so this chapter I really didn't like because he used so many different examples to prove the same thing, and I couldn't really relate to most of them. But they were basically talking about, like it says in the first sentence, if you can't prove what you want to, demonstrate something else and pretend that they're the same thing. And he was talking about, like, how to sound good and how to, like, have a cover over yourself and, like, hide what's underneath. So, like, for one of the examples, it was, like, about curing colds. And it said, make sure that the laboratory is reputable or has an impressive name. So he's all about what sounds good.
Instead of, like, the actual product.
Yeah.
I agree with all the examples within this book, but they were somewhat confusing because it was a lot. I felt that it should have been more in-depth and, like, more more understanding towards some of the scenarios. They were just really, like, short and sweet, then it moved on to the next one. And it just made it so it was, like, left you on a hanger, and you're just like, what did I just read? And then you just move on to something totally new, so you just forget it, basically.
I feel like this chapter was pretty similar to, like, the first one, where none of us really understood what was happening.
So, on page 78, the author talks about how we should think in a very basic, simple way. So, he uses the example about how more people get in accidents during, like, normal weather when it's sunny and clear outside because, you know, people are on their normal routine, whether it's to get to work or to school. But when it's foggy outside, people don't get into accidents more than if it was clear weather because they're more cautious about their surroundings and other cars and people that may be driving or crossing the street. So really, when you first hear about it, you may think, well, you know, people who drive in foggy weather might get into more accidents because there's, like, an obstacle.
Which you can't see.
Exactly, so they can't see. But in reality, it's really the clear weather that causes the most accidents.
Mm-hmm. And there's been another example that he gives on page 79 that's the same concept that says it was reported that the number of deaths chargeable to steam railroads in 1 year was over 4,000. But when you really look at it, there were only 132 out of the whole 4,000 people. But when you really investigate it, there were only 132 out of the whole 4,000 that were actually passengers on the trains, and everything else was people in their cars that collided the train and other things like that. So they're really just making something sound way worse than it seems or way better than it seems.
So the last example that's in Chapter 7 is the Herons.
Yeah, so the Harris it's this woman. She's very old, ugly, tired, whatever you want to call it, I guess. And they say that she gets her hair rinsed, and then they have this picture where she's all glamified and beautiful and curvy, and she just looks way better than what she did before. And it's just so much false advertising because a hair rinse doesn't just change your whole physical appearance. Like, now she's like, she has, like, all these curves and figures, while before she was just, like, a block or whatnot.
like the book says, more credible unto the photographer than to the rinse.
Right.
So they're false advertising or misleading the consumer, just like they've done with every other exam.
And I feel like they do this in a lot of commercials now, like with the Victoria's Secret commercials.
Yeah. Or like the weight loss, Jenny Craig or something like that. Like they say, this is what I was.
They'll be like 400 pounds before, and then they'll be like 102 pounds. And you're like, there's no way.
What? In 4 weeks, like,
or even with, like, even with acne commercials now, they'll, like, look awful before, and then they'll look like they should be in Vogue after.
Exactly.
And there's no way Proactive did all that.
Right.
That's, like, one of the only examples that I can honestly relate to from this time period, from when the book was written.
Yeah, Chapter 7 was kind of hit or miss, mostly a miss for all of us.
Right.
So, Chapter 8, The Post-Hoc Rides Again. This was another hit or miss, and it's whether you understand what he's talking about in this, honestly. I mean, that's how I took it. The first thing that caught my attention was the smoking and bad grades. And so he really made the reader guess whether it was the smokers had bad grades because they were smoking, or they had bad grades and then they started smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really the person who's reading trying to figure out what happened during the situation.
This chapter is all about, like, talking about what Helen said. Like, this one says, the more money you make, the more stock you buy, and the more stock you buy, the more income you get. So you don't know which one causes the other.
Also, another example was the rain and the crops. They were saying how the rain seems to be a blessing because it waters the crops, makes them grow and whatnot. But since it's the season of heavy rainfall, it may damage or even ruin the crops so that way it doesn't grow at all.
Okay, so Chapter 9 talks about how to staticulate.
So Chapter 9 was really about... It was a review of all the other chapters. It told the reader how to look at advertising and to see what the people are doing to make you want to buy their products. Or
so this chapter is basically about manipulating the readers by using statistics. So basically, it's kind of like a cheat sheet for us to watch out for, like, the manipulation and the false advertisement. So it kind of gives us, like, the behind-the-scenes, so to speak, insight of what's really going on. So, yeah, Helen's going to talk about the example, and yeah.
So the example that really stuck out to me was how some of the advertisers use the kids in the family income to lower the family income. So they would do it by the mean, and they would add up everybody's income, including the children, who obviously don't make anything because they're, like, toddlers. So it would lower the family income by a lot. So that really stuck out to me because I have seen ads with, you know, talking about family income, whether it be in, you know, somebody running for governor or something like that, or one of those easy, like, cash for gold or something like that. So that really stuck out to me. Another example is on page 120, and you can see the picture of a woman using an egg beater, and she says, "I just love my new mixed-up egg beater. It's so flimsy and cheap." And then if you look at the paragraph above it, you can see how the author talks about how copywriters don't just do stuff with statistics. They also go around with, like, English and stuff like that. So they'll say, instead of flimsy and cheap, they'll say light and economical.
All right, so now we're going to do chapter 10. It's called How to Talk Back to a Statistic.
So in the beginning of this chapter, he talks about that you don't need, like, hardcore statistical information from a lab, but you can prod things with 5 simple questions and still find the answers without learning a lot.
So the questions he's asking us to look for are, who says so? How does he know? Did someone change the subject? And does it make sense?
And he used examples within those 5 questions to talk about.
Well, wait, this is only 4 questions. So the 5 questions are, who says so? What's missing? How does he know? Did someone change the subject? And does it make sense?
So on the 3rd paragraph, the author talks about the economic structure and how all of the, well, he says the cracks in the economic structure were joyously overlooked, and all sorts of evidence was adduced and statistically supported to show that we had no more than entered the stream of prosperity. So basically that part, this part of the chapter was just talking about, like, a biased statement and, you know, the opinions of other people.
This part of the chapter began to talk about stock.
But the way that the stock was split was kind of iffy. I didn't understand what they were saying at first, but when I actually started to look at the picture, it made a lot more sense. It was showing that 3 men who were on top owned 3/4 of the stock, while the other thousands of people, 3,000 of people, they had 1/4 of the stock, which was kind of strange to me. I thought that was unfair, but it's true. So it's like, what can you do?
And this concludes our podcast. Thanks for listening.